I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Friday, January 19th, 2018. The time is 3:30 p.m. We are here in Juneau. Committee members present today, Vice Chair Senator Coghill, Senator Bishop, and I want to pause and say welcome to the Resources Committee. Glad to have you.
Thank you.
I expect Senator Meyer and Wilikowski will be along shortly. Excused today are Senator von Imhoff and Senator Stedman. Thank you so much to Ann and Kelsey, who are helping us out recording the meeting and doing the audio for us. Today, the committee has one item on the agenda. We're going to take up the subject of our state forests with the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Forestry. 20 million acres of state land is managed by our state forester. Alaska has the largest forest in the country, the Tongass National Forest. In terms of access for multiple use, the Tongass has also been a source of contention between the state and federal government. Alaska's state forests are therefore the primary means of keeping the timber industry viable. Managing timber sales and the economy of the communities that rely on the forests for their way of life is the charge of our presenters. So I welcome Mr. Chris Meisch, the Division Director of Forestry and the Alaska State Forester, and Heidi Hansen, the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. So welcome.
Thank you very much, Chair Giesel. I would like to start by just providing a brief overview of what we'll be discussing today, to include regional differences in scale, markets, products, and types of facilities, primary manufacturing, log export, secondary manufacturing, non-timber forest products, and woody biomass projects, including the scale and types of fuels. And we really appreciate having this opportunity to discuss these things with you. And when I say we, I'm referring to Chris Meisch.
Well, thanks, Heidi. And for the record, my name is Chris Meisch, Director of Division of Forestry. And we're going to start out with an overview here of the primary forest products businesses and their locations around the state. This map's from 2015, which is our most recent document on this topic. About every 5 years, we get this information updated through a timber product output report that comes out through our program with the Forest Inventory Analysis and our federal partners. And it's a great document for all kinds of information about forest products in the state. There's three of these reports that cover different sections. We'll make sure you get the URLs. They're put out by the University of Montana, who's contracted nationally to help states do this type of work. And it's very, very good sets of data, and I'll share some of that data with you today. That's where this map comes from.
So, thank you, Director Meisch. Excuse me one moment. I just wanted to recognize that Senator Meyer has joined us. Go ahead and proceed. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. So as you can see on the main map there, mill types, they are looking at sawmills, log home manufacturing facilities, cedar products, firewood, tonewood, which is just the market name for music wood, so wood that's used for in pianos, guitars, all kinds of musical instruments, and then fuel pellets. And you can see in the expanded maps more precisely where those are located around the state of Alaska. So there's about 60 primary forest product manufacturers in Alaska as of 2015, and the Alaska forest products industry had total sales value of about $114 million. So that includes sawn material as well as export logs, and we'll get into more details on those topics as we go through the presentation. But I did want to give you a trend. That value is about a 19% decrease from 2011, so that's the five-year span between these reports. And then from 2005 to 2011, that dropped also during that period, and the drop was 35%. So you can see the trend line has been pretty horrendous for the decrease in value, and that's primarily to what's occurred here in Southeast Alaska, and we'll talk more specifically about that. There is a bright spot hidden in those numbers, though. If you exclude the log export and residues part of those numbers, the primary wood products manufacturing actually rose by 28% in that last 5 year period, and their sales were $23 million in value, and 66% of those products all are sold to markets in the state. So within that story that looks not so good that I first started with there is a bright spot in there about our in-state manufacturing and the markets for that, and we've actually seen some growth in that value. To give you an example of what's happened to the workforce during this time period, in 1989, the workforce peaked in the forest product sector with 4,200 workers. And today we have about 1,215 workers in the state. And that includes logging, forestry work such as tree planting, thinning, that type of activity, as well as the actual wood products manufacturing. About 58% of those numbers are in the wood manufacturing piece, and the remainder are in those the service and logging side of things. So that's a pretty good snapshot of what the current industry looks like in terms of numbers. And I'm going to walk through different regions of the state and try and describe the scale. And there's very much differences around the state because of the different forest types we have. We're going to start in southeast Alaska with the Viking Sawmill located in Craig. And you can see there's an aerial picture there of the facility. And it's the largest sawmill that's currently operating in Alaska. They make a wide range of sawn products for export and domestic use, but primarily for export. Very important for this facility is they have access, both deep water port, tidewater, and also road access. Those are key things for any type of facility to have if you're located here in southeast. This is what the mill looks like inside. Its head rig is cutting an old growth log there, which is producing lumber. They have, I think, some 35 different specialty products they make for customers around the world, but primarily Asian customers. And of course, a byproduct of this process are wood chips and sawdust. And some of this material gets used in the biomass piece of the equation, and we'll talk about that. But this mill produces way more volume than we can currently use. So a lot of the chips actually go down south via barge for a paper mill.
Director Meisch, a question. Could you, for our listeners and also for us, could you tell us the difference between old growth and new growth?
Yes, Madam Chair. Old growth is a term that's used to describe large, older logs or forests that occur all over Alaska, both the boreal forest and southeast Alaska and the coastal rainforest. Of course, the coastal rainforest has much larger trees than we do up north. And it's typically an age-based measurement, and it depends on who you talk to about where the cutoff is between old growth and young growth. But typically, once a tree in southeast Alaska is pushing into the 150-plus range in age, people would start talking about that as an old-growth tree. It can get much older, 200, 300 years old, even 400 years old. Mm-hmm. So if you go down to California to the redwoods, that's a good example of old-growth by most people's definition. Up in the interior, a white spruce tree to be old-growth would have to be in the 150-plus, 200 age class. And that doesn't happen a lot because of the fire regime we have in the interior, but I've measured a white spruce as old as 360 years old on an island in the Yukon River where the fire couldn't get to it. But it eventually got killed by bark beetles. That was just too bad. But young growth, so that's places we've already managed. We've already harvested the trees once, and so it's the first rotation of timber that grows back. And most of the lower 48, they're on third, fourth, and fifth growth forests, even sixth and seventh in some places. So, and there's a good picture here of young growth logs that are in the water. This is a Kosciuszko area in southeast Alaska. These trees are roughly about 65 years old, and the largest would be probably about 25 to 26 inches in diameter of the butt. So that's not a small tree by most people's standards, but that's considered young growth because of the age piece. Of course,
yes. One second. Senator Meyer had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on the Chairman's question. So is timber considered a renewable energy source?
Yes, through the Chair, Senator Meyer, yes. And in the United Kingdom and in the EU countries, as part of their climate mitigation strategies, they do consider wood fuels as carbon neutral. And so the one key is that they have to be sustainably produced and managed. Sustainable being a perpetual flow that you're not actually cutting into the principal, if you would, of your forests. So they are considered to be a renewable resource and a sustainable resource if managed appropriately.
Okay, great, thank you. And so help me out here. I'm from South Central, mm-hmm. but I'm told all these trees here are a second growth. Would that mean that they were all cut down at one time for probably mining purposes? And
yes, through the Chair again, Senator Meyer. Yes, this area in particular was developed pretty heavily for the mining activity that occurred here. And yes, most of the trees, probably all of the trees right in the immediate footprint around this community are mostly second growth trees.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good. Any other questions? All right, great. Go ahead.
The other picture on this slide just depicts another very important piece of infrastructure in Southeast Alaska, which is called a log transfer facility. We usually call it an LTF. And this is where we place logs from the land into the water, because the way we transport this wood is by water, either by barges, by rafting, or on log ships like the picture here. This particular ship is loading these bundles of logs, and they're destined for one of our Asian customers. These probably are going to China. That's the main market for most of the young growth material. And to that point, this is a map that depicts some of the ports that the our logs move to in China. And I wanted to give a shout out to a sister division here, the Division of Agriculture, because they provide a very important inspection service for what's called a phytosanitary certificate that has to be issued before the logs can move into these other countries. That certificate assures the importing country that the logs are free from insect pests. And the one in particular pest they were concerned about is called a pinewood nematode. And so that was a big effort about 15 years ago to certify our wood that we're free of that particular pest. They also have an option to do third-party fumigation, because when China first opened up to their market, there were not many ports that had fumigation facilities that were on shore. And so the fumigations were being done on board the ship in South Korea. Logs didn't actually leave the ship, but they were fumigated in place in the hull. And so our Division of Ag actually sends a phytosanitary inspector there to observe that process, to certify that it was done correctly and for the amount of time required, so that they get the desired result, which is a pest-free log. The industry pays for that, so they cover the inspection fees as well as all the travel associated with that activity. And it's critical to this market. Heidi's got some figures there for this year, I think she wanted to share.
Yeah, Chair Giesel, I'd like to share that last year we sold 80.3 million board feet of timber for export, which had a value of 74.3 million in exports. So it's not an insignificant industry.
And just to give you a 10-year look at that, the period 2003 to 2013, which are the most available customs numbers I could look at, it was about a $1.2 billion value in logs over that time frame. So as Heidi pointed out, it is a significant part of the industry.
So a question about this fumigation process. It couldn't be done here?
Good question, Madam Chair. In most places, it's done before logs are departing the country of origin. Here in Alaska, because of our environmental conditions, cold weather, lack of facilities in Southeast Alaska to do this type of fumigation work, and a number of other factors, it's not possible for us to develop that type of facility here in Alaska, primarily because there's not enough volume to move through it, mm-hmm. to amortize the investment cost. And at some point that could change, but at this point this map does depict the ports in China that all have onshore fumigation facilities. They just added two within the last year. So the Chinese are moving pretty aggressively to make it feasible for us just to import directly without having to do that fumigation in a third location.
So is Canada a competitor? Does Canada export, and do they go to China also?
Yes, Madam Chair, there are many worldwide competitors. New Zealand, Canada, South America, Scandinavian countries all have Russia's a big competitor. Their logs move across their border, though, as opposed to usually through the ports. But yes, it's a worldwide commodity, and so we have competitors from around the world. This lower map here does depict some of the advantage we have. Alaska is very close from sailing time to the Asian market, and so that does give us a cost advantage and a time advantage. So so the short answer is yes, we're in a worldwide business. Moving north up to Fairbanks, and I think, Senator Coghill, you asked a question about this. I heard right as I was sitting down, and this is the pellet mill, Superior Pellets LLC, that's located in North Pole. It's a primary manufacturing facility. It produces wood pellets. The picture there is of the two wood pellet presses that actually produce the pellets. The process is the wood comes in as a wood chip. It goes through a hammer mill to make it even finer, almost like a rock flour. and then that is processed, dried, and then forced through dyes that are in those presses, and you get the result that looks like this, a wood pellet. And many people refer to those as grouse pellets. If you're a grouse hunter and walk around in the woods, that's pretty much the same diameter and size and almost the same consistency. They're like Mother Nature's pellet manufacturer. These pellets are used both in residential and commercial space heating facilities. Picture in the middle there are the bags that go to residential customers and go through retail outlets in the state. And then that third picture is a picture of a bulk delivery truck that looks like a water delivery or a fuel truck. That's actually a pellet truck. And that little white tube that's going from the truck up to the top of the silo has an auger in it, and it actually loads pellets out of that truck into that silo. And that's how we move pellets in bulk situations. They also sometimes use what's called a super sack, which is a really large sack that you can load, and but you need some heavy cranes and things or to move that around. But these are the two most common ways to sell pellets here in Alaska at this point. And we'll get more into biomass later, so this is still kind of the overview. Then we take a step down a little bit into the different scale of manufacturing facilities. The picture there on the left is a log turning mill that turns logs to uniform diameters to make it easy to produce log homes, cabins, things of that nature. And then that band mill on the right is a wood miser band mill. They're very popular here in Alaska. And you can see there's a very small log on that band mill that that gentleman is cutting, but he'll make a nice timber out of that and use that in a construction project probably at his home there. And there's many small operations like this throughout the state of Alaska. We're going to move now into a little bit of an example of secondary manufacturing. There's not as much of that as we would like here, but this is where you really start adding some very high value to your wood products. This is a really great example from Haines, Alaska. It's called Fairweather Steelworks, started up by some folks that had a vision, and they've produced a really world-class ski that's made mostly from Alaska wood. It's not all entirely Alaska wood, but they use Sitka spruce in the core stock. And what's really impressive there, this is spalted birch that's sound, and they use that as the top sheet. They make that veneer, put it on a top sheet. You can kind of see that in some of the ski examples. Those skiers are holding up, especially that snowboard. That top sheet there is that birch, and that's procured locally up in the Haines area, as well as the Sitka spruce, a very small-scale logging, but very much a high-value operation. These folks are getting a world reputation for the kind of skis they produce, and part of that's the heli ski operations we have in that part of the world, so they get exposed to this, and this is a very unique product. The other really cool thing they're doing with it, you can't see it too well, but there's custom art on the guy in the middle, on the bottom of that ski, and they do all kinds of stuff. There's salmon on the one to the right. It's hard to see unless you know it's there. Some beautiful artwork goes on that. Those are all Alaska artists doing that work, and it's really a cool product. So it's a very important part of the industry. Here's another great example up in Fairbanks, the Alaska Bowl Company. These are birch bowls that are turned at this facility in Fairbanks. There's a picture of the production floor there. The lathe is actually right in the middle, but without knowing exactly where it is, it's hard to describe to you. But they cut those bowls out of one block of wood, and the lathe can cut multiple bowls out of that one piece of wood. Again, a high-value product. You know, it may not have $100 million associated with it yet, but, you know, someday they might get there. This next one is another great example. This is up in the Mat-Su Valley. This we call a non-timber forest product, only because it's not the wood itself. This is the sap from the tree. And this is from a company called Kahiltna Birchworks, and they've been one of the early pioneers of this industry in Alaska. It's a picture of their evaporator that's in their sap production facility. They have a retail store. I'd put the ratio up there just to show you the amount of work that goes into birch syrup. It's a 71 ratio. Maple syrup's more like a 35-to-40-to-1 ratio. So that's how much sap you have to boil down to get one gallon or one pint of product. The one thing they've been able to do to help speed that process is I think they're still doing this, they use a reverse osmosis process to concentrate the sap first, and then that reduces the boiling time in the evaporator. So there's a lot of innovative things that have gone on with this. There's a lot of hardworking Alaskans figuring out how to make these businesses work, And you got to really, really, I really love to see these kind of things happen in the state because it's really encouraging. We're going to shift now a little bit more to the wood biomass side of the industry because that's a really important way to use some of the residues and also produce some of this as a primary product from the woods. These types of activities around our communities really help us with fuel reduction around communities, and I'll touch on that in a couple of places in the presentation. So what we're going to do is look at the types of wood fuels used, the scale of the operations, similar to just what we just did with the sawn part of the industry, how it's used, electrical generation we're going to touch on because there's some really neat things starting to potentially be feasible with that aspect of it, and then the larger scale combined heat and power operations. And right there is just a basic example of what all the different biomass looks like, wood chips, solid wood, and pellets, and we have systems in Alaska that are using all three of these fuel sources to produce heat primarily and a couple now power. This is a map that's produced by the AEA. It's part of their renewable energy program and the funding that the legislature has provided in the past to help get renewable energy projects going around Alaska. This just shows you where feasibility studies for wood biomass projects have been completed in the state. And this next map shows where we actually have operating projects, projects under construction or design. And you can see, if you would have looked at this map 12 years ago, there have been maybe one or two blue circles on it. So we've made tremendous progress with this, and at all scales and really all over the state. And really, the smaller community that you're in, the more impact these kind of facilities have. And we'll touch more on that in just a few minutes. Again, we're going to start out here in Southeast in Ketchikan. This is a relatively new project that uses pellets to heat the airport at Ketchikan. And this is a new building there to the left. Next time you leave the airport, take a walk down here. There's, I think, some interpretive signs there now. You can look through these windows. You can look right into the boiler room, and you can see these boilers doing what they do, which is producing heat to heat the facility. The silo right there next to the building is where the pellets are stored, and there is a small manufacturer of pellets in Ketchikan, and so I think there's a combination of locally produced pellets and then pellets that come out of the Pacific Northwest in super sacks that provide pellets into the Southeast market. This next one's a little bigger operation. This is up in Galena, and this is a wood biomass heating system. That's a mesh spit boiler there on the left that burns wood chips. To the right there is the actual chip storage area. There's an auger that travels along the bottom of that where there's that long row of chips on the bottom right of the picture. The auger pulls those chips onto the conveyor that's right below that. That runs it up to the day bin, and then that day bin actually feeds this boiler. The boiler is being used in Galena to heat, I think it's 17 buildings that are on a loop. It's part of the old military base there, so it was fortunate they had that loop. And it just started up operations, I think, about 2 years ago. A notable thing about this is some of the wood is coming off Native Corporation lands there around the community, but we also have a long-term timber sale, a 20-year sale, that helps support this. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we talk about sale types. These are the facilities there where they store their chips, a pretty unique building they put up. They made great use of those containers and some building material they had there that keeps the rain and weather off the chips so they're easier to handle. And they actually have done all their workforce development. There was some training offered in the community to operate and run the harvesting equipment, which they procured. And so it's had several small startup businesses as a result of them going with this biomass operation in their community. So they've actually created jobs associated with this activity. Moving back upriver to the village of Tanana, there they're using solid wood boilers. This is a smaller community. The heat loads aren't as big. They can't support a chip system. So they've gone this route with these Garn Model 2000 wood boilers. They're like a big wood stove, essentially. That's obviously the firebox. You can see the chunks of wood that are in there. They only have to fire these boilers two times a day, even in the coldest weather, because what you do is you fill that chamber with wood, you light it, and you can see these fans that are on the front of the boilers. Those are a forced air draft, so that fire burns just as hot as ever, and it burns very cleanly that way. You don't get soot and a lot of particulate. and the energy is stored in a big water jacket around those boilers, and that's where that heat goes, and they can fire those only two times a day to heat the facility they're heating there. The biggest installation of I've seen of these is a larger school where they actually have three of these boilers chained together. So you can actually chain them together to get higher heat loads.
Director Meisch, pause for a moment. Senator Bishop had a question.
Just a comment. He's telling you the truth, because I've been at the back end of these boilers, and they are the exhaust emissions. It's amazing. It's like it's clean.
Wow.
So, yeah, they work well.
I just wanted to demonstrate the employment opportunities that occur in a community like this. You have a resident there that goes out on his own on either tribal or state lands with permit and harvests wood that he then brings into the city, which owns these boilers, and sells the wood to the city. And so you've created an opportunity for someone in the community, actually more than one person. There's quite a few people that sell wood. I didn't have space to put this in, but the best story about this was a family from up in Stevens Village that worked for about a month putting together a large raft of wood that they harvested. They floated it down the Yukon River here to Tanana, pulled it up to the shore, and sold it to the city. And it's a great picture of them moving this big raft of logs down the Yukon. They got a wall tent set up on the raft, a couple boats, kids, dogs running around on it. It took them, weeks to float it down, but it was pretty cool. You don't see that very much anymore. And then, of course, just operating this equipment, it's not complicated, but it does create jobs to do that operation and maintenance. This is an exciting development that's happening up in Fairbanks. This is the first, what I'd call, small-scale opportunity to produce electrical energy from wood. It looks very promising. It's a technology that comes out of Finland. This company is called Volter. They've been around about 15 years there and have many of these units installed in community buildings, a community where they heat, 15 homes and provide power to those homes. And this is a little different technology. It's called gasification. And so that diagram on the right kind of shows the technology. Biomass goes in the top. It can be wood chips, pellets. In this case, they use wood chips. There's a drying zone, then a paralysis zone where there's no oxygen in there, so the wood actually starts to combust. Well, it's not quite combusting yet when you're in paralysis, but as soon as you add air, it does start to combust. And that happens there in that red zone of that process, and that produces a gas that is then forced out of the system, and they actually burn that gas in a regular combustion engine. It's got to be cleaned up. It's called syngas is the name of the product, and you got to remove moisture and some impurities. But it's pretty impressive. This machine operates very reliably. The heat load for where this is going to go is the Big Dipper Ice Arena up in Fairbanks, and the borough is who's involved with this, as well as the Cold Climate Energy Center up at the University of Alaska. They've been a key player, as well as a lot of other people. But their heat load there, you can see, is going to be 2,380 MMBTUs, which is a big heat load, and 280,000 kilowatts of power will be produced. And they expect it to save the borough fairly significantly on their utility costs. This hasn't actually been installed yet. They're in the process of purchasing this. They had to do a special ordinance to allow sole source purchase of a piece of equipment so they can get crosswise with their borough purchasing regulations and low bids. And they just did that, and so this will be purchased and installed this year, and then the testing of this will occur over the next year, including air emission testing, which is going to be done by the University of Alaska Cold Climate Housing. And so they should get a real good profile on how this performs, even with the challenges we have with air issues in that community. Really interesting technology. If this pans out, it could make a huge difference in a lot of our small rural communities in the bush. So I'm going to change gears now. That's kind of the overview of what the industry looks like in the state right now. And I'd like to talk about what we need to maintain and grow the industry. And the first thing is a stable land base. I can't say that enough times. That it's dedicated for forest management and produces a consistent offering of timber sales that you can rely on. The best way to do that is a mix of land ownership, so both state, private. The two trusts are very important, the Mental Health Trust and the University Trust, and, of course, federal land. But the federal land piece has not been the bright spot, and we're trying to turn that around. I think we're making good progress and we'll talk about some success stories in that arena. Next is an access to markets. If you don't have a market, doesn't matter what you make. And so we have both domestic opportunities with energy in particular, and there's also international opportunities, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. There's a range of timber sale options for us, and you guys are probably already pretty familiar, but we'll go through those real quickly, and I'll describe the strengths and the weaknesses and some of the challenges and some of the long-term sales that we've tried to put together, long-term being 10, 20, 25 years, because that's usually what the industry would like, so they can amortize investments if they're building, you know, capital investments. And then we're going to talk about the continued use of the Good Neighbor Authority, which is a relatively new authority with the federal government that allows us to do work on federal lands on their behalf and help them get wood and other products moving again off national forests. So that's what we're going to talk about next, the forests in Alaska. We have three distinct types. We have the boreal forest up north, which is that region 3. You have the transition forest, we call it the blue area, where you have the boreal forest meeting the coastal rainforest, so you have a little mixing of the two, and then you have the true coastal rainforest, which is the green area. The Division of Forestry actually regulates commercial timber harvest on state, private, and public lands in the state as part of our state's Forest Practices Act, and those happen to be also the three zones that are the forest practices regions, and they basically mirror the type of forest that grows in each of those three locations. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about the FERPA program, but if you'd like to know more about that, feel free to ask questions. I think I left plenty of time at the end for discussion and questions from you. This is just a good graphic that shows who owns the forests in Alaska, roughly 126 million acres across the state of commercial forests, depending on which publication you want to cite. There's a little variability in that, but you can see the federal government is a very large owner of those forests, with the U.S. Forest Service in particular being a big slice of that, the red piece of the pie, and a lot of that is here in Southeast Alaska. You then have the state in the green, and then private, which are primarily Alaska Native corporations. So to talk a little bit about that secure land base, I wanted to just remind you of the state forests that we have. We've got three of them in Alaska. The Haines State Forest, created in 1982, and about 286,000 acres in size. The Tanana Valley State Forest, which is 1.8 million acres, that one was created in 1983. And then our most recent additions have been the Southeast State Forest, the first created in 2010, and then added to, we doubled the size in 2011. Unfortunately, it's only 48.5 thousand acres, but those acres have played a really large role in keeping the current industry alive in Southeast Alaska, and we'll talk more specifically about that. And then we have candidate state forests that was identified out of an administrative order under the Parnell administration that we did. It was AO 258, and it's these are other places where we have significant state lands with commercial forests that we over time have recommended to be considered for state forest designation. That's the Susitna, Copper River, Icy Bay, and on the Kenai. Just a quick map depicting the Tanana Valley State Forest and its acreage. There's two parts of the state forest. One are the actual designated acres that are in the state forest, and those are the dark colors that are on the map. And then you see those white colored polygons. Those are called classified forest lands. Those lands have been classified for forest use in the area planning process, so they're not actually in the state forest, but we still manage those forests in conjunction with the state forest. And all the area plans zone different parts of our state ownership for either wildlife, forestry, recreation, disposal. It's basically like a high-level zoning. But for us to have that long-term management piece being classified or a state forest are the two key things that potential investors are going to look for in terms of the secure land base. This steps us down here to Southeast Alaska, the Haines State Forest up north there in the dark green. And then I put this slide in because it shows what kind of mills we had, gosh, about not even 10 years ago. And unfortunately, number one up there, Icy Straits Lumber, is, I shouldn't say unfortunately, they are fortunately still there in Hoonah, Alaska. About a relatively small mill. They can do maybe a couple million feet of production a year, very specialized material. But number two there, Silver Bay Logging, is gone, out of business. Number three, Viking Lumber, I showed you pictures of when we first started out. It's really the last large mill in Southeast Alaska. And then number four and number five, both gone. since this map was originally produced just a few short years back. And so that reinforces that trend that I shared about employment and value. Most of that's because of what's happened here in Southeast and the lack of enough economic volume being produced on federal ground. So a quick review of the state timber sale methods and types. We have five ways that we have in statutes that we can offer timber sales. We have the regular competitive sale process, which is called our 120 sale authority. It's just the highest bid takes the sale. And it can have one bidder or it can have five or ten bidders. We can do it either as oral outcry or sealed bid. And if we think there's not much competitive interest, we typically will use sealed bid. So if someone doesn't just show up at an oral auction and look around the room and see only one bidder and they bid the low price. So it makes someone put their best price on the table if it's a sealed bid process. We then have small negotiated sales, which have to be under 500,000 feet. Those are the 115 sales. Those typically go to the smaller operators. We do a number of those, mostly up in interior Alaska is where that authority is used. It's rarely used down here in Southeast. We then have our high value added negotiated sales. It's called the 123 authority. That allows us to negotiate a sale. And we have a bit of a competitive process we can tack onto the front of that. That's a request for proposals where we'll ask them information about value of the product, type of product, number of jobs they expect to create. You know, we look at their business track record to see if they're a going concern or just a startup. And that has scores associated with it, and then we can choose who we would negotiate the actual final contract. But one of the requirements under the 123 authority is it has to be high value added, and that's defined in regulation. So lumber, different value added products. We've only done one of these sales up in Fairbanks. It was with the Superior Pellets, and unfortunately when the energy prices crashed, so did their demand for pellets, so they have not actually signed the contracts. It was two back-to-back 10-year sales that would have supplied material for that facility. Those are still available over-the-counter, so if conditions improve, we'll probably be able to execute those. The next is large negotiated sales, the 118 authority. We use those quite a bit here in Southeast. Similar process to the 123. Only main difference is they do not have to be producing value-added products. Typically, they are. That is the way we move state wood to the local mills here in Southeast because they are at a competitive disadvantage. A log going in the log export market carries a higher value even though it's being shipped overseas. It's more valuable to do that than it is to actually cut it into a product. And so this is the main tool that we used. And just a few years ago, you helped us modernize this statute by striking three criteria that were becoming problematic for us to continue to use. And so that was a good deal. And so most of the wood that Viking Lumber buys from the state is through this 118 timber sale process. The next one is salvage sales, 117. It has some advantages to quickly move wood to market, but it's got to be wood that's distressed, either disease or insects. That's the whole purpose behind it, is get some value out of it and prevent the further spread. And then the last one there is personal use sales, which is just individual permits and wood for, you know, basically a family. This is a nice picture of the governor signing that 118 bill that passed, I think it was 2 years, maybe it's been three sessions back. Time kind of blends together after a while. But we went down to the Viking Mill to sign this bill, and that's obviously the workforce there at the mill, and the governor signed it there during lunch break, and I think I heard a couple of people were grumbling at first, and then they realized what was going on, and it was actually a pretty good time. We got a tour of the mill and worked out well. So next I'd like to review what the steps in a timber sale program are for actually doing a sale. Our process is a much streamlined process compared to the federal government, and the two trusts have an even more streamlined process than ours, but I'll walk you through ours. First off, we have to start with the five-year schedule of timber sales. That's the FYSTS is what we all call it. And we put those out about every 2 years for each of our area offices, although we can put them out yearly. And what we have to do is list in those schedules where we think we're going to be doing timber sales on the state forest or on state land. So it's basically just a notice to both the industry and the public. And it covers a five-year period of time so they can look out and see what kind of volume and sales are going to be available. That's not a decision document. We do take comment on it, but it's not something we use in the decision-making process. It's really just a notice document. The actual decision document is the best interest finding, which I think you're all very familiar with. Everyone calls them a BIF. And that's where we make a decision whether we're actually going to dispose of a timber or not. And there's a process we go through with that. And those documents, that document is an appealable document, so we can have that occur. That goes up to the commissioner's office if that does occur. Typically, we've seen very few appeals on our projects until just a few years ago when we started doing a lot more work in Southeast Alaska with our program and some of the NGOs that do not like us selling wood have filed administrative appeals. In fact, every sale we've done since 2 years ago has been administratively appealed. So that's been new for us. We didn't used to have that happen. And the five times we have gone to court over the last 30 years, we've won all five cases. Now, no one's taken us to court down here yet. I'm going to knock on wood. And so we're working through the process on a couple of appeals right now for some of our sales down here. And we expect to be able to bring those sales out still hopefully this year in 2018. As part of that process, we also have to do a forest land use plan called the FLUP. And that's site-specific information about the sale once we've cruised it, seen where the roads are going to go, you know, basically designed it. We put this document out for also the industry and the public. It's another public process document. It's also a decision document. So people get two bites at the apple right now if we don't run these two things concurrently. So typically for our regular sale program, which is 0 to 5 years in length for competitive sale, we'll issue these concurrently so we don't have a lot of extra process to go through. And the BIF is only required to run 21 days, but the FLUPs are required to run 30, so we just run them both 30 days just so people don't get confused about it. Sometimes they run longer if we think it's needed to get adequate public input on these sales. Now, when we step into a longer-term sale, this is one point I'll make about one of our challenges. It's very difficult for us to prepare FLUPs 15, 20, 25 years out because it means you have to do all the work on the ground, and we don't have the staff or the money to do that. So the way we've been working these longer-term commitments is we prepare the FLUPs in five-year increments within the 20 or 25-year sale. And so, but that is a challenge, and we've seen the figure of process that has worked out. I'm going to give you the experience of the places where we have done these sales, because unfortunately it hasn't worked out in every case, and I shared the one with the pellet mill already. The one that we did spend a lot of energy and time on was the Toke project. It was for a combined heat and power facility that AP&T had proposed, and that's when energy costs spiked when we were 100 plus a barrel. It made a lot of sense for them. They're an isolated grid. They only use diesel for producing energy. And so it was very expensive. It's only a 2-megawatt load, I think, in Toke, so it's not a high load for power. And so they proposed to purchase a long-term sale from the state of Alaska to help them convert their facility to a wood-fired power plant. And so we started out with a 118 process because there was no one else really that we didn't think would compete with them as the local utility. Got a long way through the process, and all of a sudden a competitive interest did show up. And that was Young's Timber, which had similar plans for his facility that he was upgrading and making investments in. So quickly we became convinced we didn't want to be the person that chose the winner or loser there. So we went to a 120 process, which was back to a competitive sale. And so that took some time to go through all that. This was over about a two-year period of time. When it finally came time to put the sale up and sell it, nobody bought it. One bid. So,
Senator Bishop, question.
Madam Chair, what did it cost Encumbered to do that and then no sale?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Bishop. I'd have to get the actual numbers to you, but let me say a lot of staff, time, energy, and funding went in to prepare that, get it through the public process, and then to not have a bid. And so we'll come back to this because this has some bearing on the proposals we're currently getting in the division and about us being, especially in the fiscal environment we're in now, this was during the good days we did this Toke project. And I even have less ability to do that kind of speculative work. In fact, I can't do that kind of speculative work at this point. And I'll give you some good examples of that with the Susitna project.
Senator Bishop.
Just a quick follow-up. So is there any kind of recourse for a percentage of your time back in? You know, like you have a contractor that has a performance bid to do a project, right, for a DOT project. They don't perform. I mean, I'm just, we're in different economic times now.
So through the chair to the senator, we've talked a lot about that. We've talked maybe about some bonding up front, other things we could consider to really make sure someone is very serious and have done their due diligence. And both these parties were, but conditions changed. And so, yes, the short answer is yes. We're thinking about ways to deal with that aspect. I already mentioned the Galena space heating project. That's one of the real successes. We use the 120 process for that, so a straight competitive sale. Usually there's only one utility in a community, so they're not really competing. And this is a 20-year sale that will provide a long-term commitment by us to help provide the wood resources they need for that facility. And we're just ready to execute that agreement. And the community is very pleased with it. We had very few public comments. There were no objectors. So people realize the benefits they can get out of this type of work, especially the other part I'd like to mention. When we manage these stands, we're actually cutting cottonwood, hardwood stands to do this, as well as some spruce stands down there. But that cottonwood comes right back, the aspen comes right back, so it's a habitat thing. And all of a sudden you're attracting moose and stuff right in close to a community, which has another big food security piece that goes with it. So you've gotten jobs, you've gotten fire protection, you're getting food. So over time you build a really compelling reason to think about biomass for these communities. I already mentioned Superior Pellets, so I'm not going to go into that one any further. This is where I'd like to talk about some recent proposals that we've had in the Division of Forestry for some long-term commitments to wood. And what's going on in the Asian market right now, particularly in Japan, Japan is committed to turning off their nuclear power generators to produce electricity because of what happened at Fukushima. And one of the things they're looking at is going to biomass to do that, because again, they also consider it a climate-friendly wood source as opposed to some of their other options. And so they are looking around for potential commitments for long-term fiber supplies. And so we've had at least three or four companies now come kick tires, I would call it, with the Division of Forestry. About what kind of commitments could we make in the Susitna Valley to supply a long-term supply of wood. And if you'll remember, one of the things I pointed out in the start of this is it's a state forest, and we unfortunately do not have a state forest in the Susitna Valley. It's just state land. And so that's one of our first challenges, because this wood, if it's going to be used in utility power production, has to be certified by a third-party certifier as being sustainable. So that means either the Forest Stewardship Council or the SFI is the name of the other certifying body, one of the other main ones, the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, has to certify that you're producing this wood sustainably and not over-harvesting, and we're confident we could pass the test on that. But this is not cheap, and it's not something you do and then have a TOC example occur. So there's a little chicken and egg here. They can't go further with their project because I don't have certified wood yet. This is not just a simple thing to do to certify these forests to meet the standard they need for their market. So here's an actual example of what it would cost us to certify. And this is for the Southeast State Forest, and it's done in two phases. Whoops, I'm sorry. I think I somehow got that thing up on the screen there. We'll let the expert come down here, Heidi. Thank you. That was easy. We've been talking with the SFI for about the last 8 months, and we decided to use the state forest here in Southeast as the example, just kind of a test bed, so we could get our head around what the process would look like and what the costs might be. So under phase one, we actually have reviewed the SFI standard, including the kind of documentation we have to produce. We have to actually produce what's called an evidence manual that the third-party auditors are going to look at when they come in to make sure we meet the SFI standard. That third-party consultant works with our division to develop the documents and basically dry runs us through what an audit's going to look like, so that we're pretty confident up front that we can pass the audit and deal with issues that might come up. We then have an accreditation certified body, which is another consultant that comes in, third-party, and they actually run us through the audit to the SFI standard. And I would think we would have no issues with passing that, but it's not a guaranteed thing. You have to, they'll issue like what an auditor would normally issue. You might have a finding about something that we would have to fix, and it could be something about our planning standards or road construction standards, but it's all based on that sustainability aspect of their certification. The cost to do this for the Southeast State Forest, which is about 50,000 acres, is about $19,000 plus travel expenses for the auditors. So I would say that might double the expense, depending on how many auditors and how much travel. They actually go out to the woods, too, and look at stuff. They're not just doing this in the office. Luckily, right now, they do have what's called a partner program in SFI, and it's the five biggest customers that are paper-using customers that want certified wood. They're willing to underwrite some of the certification costs for people that are certifying because they want to assure they have a good supply worldwide of certified fiber, and it's just called the Partners Program. So that would save us about $9,300 if we went that route.
Senator Bishop had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, excuse me. Sustainable Forest Initiative, who are they? Where are they located? Can you give me a little
bit? You bet. Through the Chair, Senator Bishop. SFI is a U.S.-based initiative that originally came out of the Pulp and Paper Association, but has since spun off into its own nonprofit organization. We're in response to the FSC standard, which kind of was the first one out of the chute, which was primarily started up by environmental interests. So there's a little different perspective in terms of what the two certifying bodies look at. I would say the SFI one is definitely a much more practical and oriented towards meeting a very high standard, but being feasible to do that without considering a lot of the things the FSC standard takes a look at. FSC takes a lot more time at looking at some social considerations, environmental considerations. They have some restrictions on certain types, like old growth is one of the issues we would be faced with under an FSC certification. We're not under an SFI certification, and how that's handled. Does that answer your question? Yep. You're welcome. So phase two is once you've certified, there's an ongoing audit, and they audit one part of your operation every year just to keep you on your toes. You don't just get an audit and you're good for 20 years. So they'll come back each year and take a look at one aspect of your program and also charge you your fee, $14,000 plus travel. If you want to access the energy market, though, you have to do this. And a good example is the Southern U.S. and European Union. The pellet industry has exploded in the southern U.S. over the last 10 years. It rivals the paper and pulp industry now, and it's because those pellets are all going to the United Kingdom and to Europe to produce energy, electricity. As they shut off coal plants, they're switching to wood because of that, again, climate piece, and that's one of their strategies under that whole process in the EU. But they want that sustainability certification. So just recently, the state of Florida, state of North Carolina, state of Arkansas, have all certified under the SFI standard, and I think almost all the southern states now are certified under that standard. Some states have dual certified, both under FSC and SFI, just to take the wind out of the sails of some people that don't think SFI is as rigorous as FSC, excuse me. So at any rate, obviously the Asian markets have not moved as quickly in this arena, but I think we're starting to see where they are potentially going to be a customer for the same type of product. So at some point we're going to have to get our head around, do we certify or not? The other thing certification does is I think it really helps with social license to actually manage a forest, because you're really having a third party come in and give you a top to bottom review of how you do your business and how you conduct it. I can't help to think that it wouldn't help with some of the challenges that we get if we ever got taken to a court, if a judge looked at that and saw that we were a third-party certified, land manager. I think you'd have that would carry a lot of weight. And we're actually pushing the Forest Service and Southeast to consider certifying. That's why we did the Southeast State Forest. I've proposed to them for them to consider jointly certifying some land at the same time we do it, which would help with costs. And I personally believe that would help with some of their litigation. That's my belief, though. I'm not sure I've convinced them yet. So stay tuned on that piece.
If I could ask a
Yes. Director Meisch, Senator Coghill has a question.
So the 48,000 or some acres that we have in Southeast probably are the critical element in this certification, I would think, probably because that's more likely to be the international sale.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, it actually isn't because the volume, some of the volume that's coming off of the Forest Service lands can be exported in the round. And that's a unique condition that Alaska is the one place that we're allowed to do that. But we have to ask for an exemption on each project. So that has to be approved by the regional forester in the Forest Service. But if they don't have a local market for it, which we don't yet for young growth logs, that is the only market. So that's the only way you're going to move that kind of young growth material. We're still managing a mix of old growth and young growth on our property. Same thing with the Forest Service. But the young growth log is really starting to come into its own. It's going to be 15, maybe 20 years before there's really significant volumes, like 100 million plus a year, that you could start thinking about manufacturing with it. And we're actually conducting a forest inventory with the forest right now. We're in the year three of that, where we're taking a real intense look at the young growth resource on federal and state lands to give some better projections of how much wood comes on year by year, decade by decade. Where do you hit a tipping point where all of a sudden you have enough of that volume, you can start thinking about some manufacturing opportunities. And I'll suggest some ways we could do that here at the end of the talk. So there are some real benefits and risks with this certification. How far ahead do we try and get with this? It's going to cost time. It's going to cost money. And I can't take staff away. My staff's so small now. If I divert them to working on this, it means I'm not going to get a timber sale out. And I got to get the timber sales out because that's what the industry is surviving on right now down here. So those are the things we're struggling with, capacity and cost. So if you guys sometimes hear from some of the companies that come talk to us, I'm giving them the same story I'm telling you. So they don't always like it because they'd like us to just go ahead and certify and then put up a big sale. And we keep saying, well, do your due diligence to make sure your project's viable and then come back and talk. Maybe you put some money down and we get started on this. So this gets to your point too, Senator, that we talked about earlier. Okay, back here in Southeast and really all around the state, access is a key to all of this, and keeping access and developing access. And we've been very fortunate to be able to receive some money in the better days where we got some Roads to Resources funds through DOT, through RSAs, and actually a couple years we had some direct appropriations in the capital budgets to help us build infrastructure around the state. This is a road project that was just completed this year on Gravina Island. It's 8 miles of road and 6 bridges that access a significant new volume in the Southeast State Forest, as well as Forest Service volume. And so this is just a picture of one of the smaller bridges going in and what the roads look like. They're resource development roads, so they're not meant to be public highways. They have turnouts. They're made for truck hauling, but they are still a multiple-use road. They can be used by the public. In fact, this road will be open to the public when we're not doing active hauling. It would make it dangerous. It accesses borough, trust, state, and federal land, so it actually was designed so it goes right along a bunch of private lots along on Gravina Island that are on the waterfront, so those property owners now have drivable access to their land instead of only ocean access. And so that was all coordinated with the borough in this project. So we're trying to get as many benefits out of this as possible when we do this type of development. This is an Indian Creek Bridge going in a couple years ago, developing new road access. We're the only other state agency besides DOT that has road construction authorities, and those come to us through our timber sale program because it's such a critical part of the timber sale program. Mm-hmm. Typically, when we build most projects with our timber sale program, we write the cost of that infrastructure off against the appraised value of the wood. So the wood is actually paying for a lot of this infrastructure. We take a lower price on the stump for it, but we get a road system or a bridge or an LTF, whatever it is. And that's been a great way to keep some things going instead of depending on capital appropriations to build that infrastructure. Because we'll benefit from this many times over as years go on. And I just listed there on the slide a couple of the projects that we've done around the state with some of the funds we had when we had a roads office. We had 2 logging engineers that were engineers that worked on this. We also use private sector engineers, and we also work with the Division of Parks and their engineering staff. And so that's just a list. The Valner Road there is listed. Boswick Road was also down on Gravina Island quite a few years back now, I think about 10. Shirleytown Bridge is up in the Matsu Valley. Willer Cache Road was Matsu Valley. And then just general southeast timber access, a new bridge in Haines at Porcupine Creek, and then this Hollis Bridge going in here. Those kind of funds really circulate many times over in the community because it's all local Alaskan contractors doing the work, and they're all hiring, for the most part, local people. So let's talk a little bit more about the Tongass and what we're trying to do down there to make it a more friendly place to try and do business, especially on our federal landscape. And what we've done is we've really partnered with the Forest Service on several fronts, under Good Neighbor Authority work, under what we call a challenge cost share, where we're doing the inventory work and workforce development. And also, this is part of what's come out of this challenge cost share, is what we call these five working circles. And these are very important concept in Southeast, because each of these working circles would have a log transfer facility at the center or somewhere near the center of this working circle. And that's really important to the Forest Service, because that's when they appraise a timber sale, they have to appraise it to an appraisal point, which is usually where the product is loaded onto a ship or reaches a mill. And right now they don't have enough appraisal points around Southeast, so they have to appraise everything great distances, and the farther away, the higher the cost. So that's this concept to do these five working circles. We've also got lists of key infrastructure pieces that would help, either by connecting road systems that are currently isolated, key bridges, other key pieces of infrastructure. And this is really a Forest Service funded effort. You know, we've provided this information along with consultation with the industry, a lot of the NGO groups that we work with. There's quite a group of people that have been working on these projects in Southeast Alaska. And then finally, the Good Neighbor Authority. This is probably the biggest news for us and for the Forest Service nationwide. I think there's 32 states now, if I remember the number right. I think it's the next slide. 19, excuse me. And let's see, to go back, I'll just use this. Well, I know it. So anyways, the Good Neighbor Authority is an authority I already explained to you that allows us to do work for the Forest Service. And we did our first large project on Kosciuszko Island this year. We sold a 29-million-foot timber sale, which is most of the volume the Forest Service sold this year on the Tongass. It's all young growth volume, and it went for double the appraised value. We used our appraisal system, our cruising system, under our timber sale contract. We used a unique feature to do the layout where it's called purchaser layout. We only laid out a third of the sale, and then the purchaser of the sale is going to lay out the other two-thirds. We'll still monitor that layout to make sure it's done correctly, but that cost is then borne by the purchaser. So we get a little less value, but we still got double the appraised value, $2.6 million off that one sale. And this will be a 10-year project. There will be a lot of activity associated with it. So our goal is to do two Good Neighbor Authority projects a year with the Forest Service. So teed up for this coming year is one at Gravina, which that road we just built will help access. It's a relatively small sale, $2 to $4 million, but we'll partner that with one of ours. And then the other one's going to be on Hecate Island, which will be a salvage sale. I think it's maybe as much as $15 million. So not near as big as our first one, but we hope to continue that effort over time and grow that program.
Director Meisch, the term layout, is that actually cutting the trees down? Does it mean?
No, Madam Chair. Layout is when we go out and design the sale on the grounds. We mark the boundaries, the type of transportation system that's going to be there, the mainline roads, the skid trails. Like this is what we call a skidder right here, and it uses what we call skidding corridors in the woods to move the felled trees out of the woods. And this is a thinning project that was done on federal land. It's actually a commercial thin, which means the material being removed actually paved its way out and was sold. And then we make what's called alleyways in the forest, where this equipment travels up and down on slash that's in that alleyway to minimize soil disturbance, and it moves the wood out of the forest that way. So layout is doing all that work so that it can be harvested. Sometimes if it's a clear cut, it's not as much work to do as if you're doing some kind of a partial removal system like this. So that's the general term for layout. Let's see. So I think I already gave you the stats on this. This is basically what we plan to do and what we have done with Good Neighbor. And then I think this is the last slide, but I want to talk a little bit about the other product that I think is going to be a real potential product for Alaska to take a hard look at as more of this young growth comes on. And I don't have a slide, unfortunately. I just ran out of time. We had some other stuff we were working on for the State of the State last night, that roadless petition. So it's a type of product that's called mass timber. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's been in the press a lot lately, the last couple of years here in North America. It also goes by the term cross-laminated timber, or CLT, and another product is MPP, mass plywood panels. And these are products that have been used in Europe for maybe 15 or 20 years, and they finally have migrated to North America. But what it allows us to do is build high-rise buildings out of wood. So you're talking 15, 20, 30. There's even a 100-story building that's on the record or design books over in Europe. And this technology, what it does is it lays up layers of wood. So you might cut 2x6, 2x8, 2x10s. Those are called laminars. And what they do is they lay those up in layers. The outside two layers are always the nice-looking, best-looking wood. And they can go up to 13 layers thick. And they just cross one over the other like this. So you got a 90-degree difference between each layer. And that creates a very strong, very stable weight-bearing product. And so they can build these panels in very large sizes, small sizes. It's really revolutionized the way we are thinking about building mid-rise buildings, especially in urban environments. There's several buildings now built in North America, but what had to occur is the building codes had to be adjusted. In almost all the big cities, you can't go over three stories with wood for fire purposes. So all the testing had to be done with this material. This stuff chars on the outside. It'll burn, but once it chars, it insulates the rest of that core from burning. So a steel beam will fail before a piece of CLT will fail on a weight test. So it's pretty interesting stuff. The really interesting thing is you partner up with an engineering and architectural firm. They design the building, so when these products are made, you're actually custom cutting each panel that's going to go into the building. It saves about a third the construction costs over concrete and steel. Those industries are not happy about this development, as you might be imagined, because the labor is very cheap. You pick them right off the truck, you put it up, and you don't have to wait for concrete to cure. You don't have that steel work that has to go into it, so it's very efficient building process. And so this allows us to vertically, you always hear vertical integration, this is linear integration. You can be a seller of that material, the mill, the architectural firm, you all get a piece of that action that goes into the building because you're selling the customer a building in China or Japan. You're not just selling them a two-by material. So the value has quite a lot of potential. We're a long way from being able to realize this, but that's the vision, if you will, that some of us are starting to think about for the young growth wood in Southeast, because we're not going to be able to compete in the two-by market with all the other competitors in the world. We're a high-cost producer of that material. But we think we can produce these panels. The plants are not super expensive to build. And I'm going on too much about it because I really feel strongly it's going to be the real future of what we can do in Southeast Alaska. But to realize that, we have to have enough wood first. This forest inventory will tell us when that's going to be, and we'll say, is that 15 years, is it 10 years, is it 20 years? But we have to start laying the groundwork for that now. So with that, maybe I'll be quiet, ask if there's any more questions or discussion, and do my best to answer your questions.
All right, very good. Very interesting presentation. Any questions? Senator Coghill.
I have a couple questions. I don't know the Southeast Forest, but I know that there's a rotation, and the 48,000 probably has to be thought of very closely on what your rotation between harvest and the new growth that can come out of it. It's mm-hmm. 65 years. Mm-hmm. So the rotation, is it exactly the same kind of tree, and is the rotation 65 years?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, it's a good question because it's not the same kind of tree. An old-growth log will have much different growth characteristics than a young-growth log just because of the time it takes to grow. That old-growth log is much older, so it's going to have tighter grain, different characteristics than a young-growth. And it really will also depend on the site. Just like agricultural products, better growing soils and ground will grow a better crop and grow it faster. Same thing with trees. And so our good sites in the southeast, 65 years would probably be your rotation length. Some could even be 50 years, maybe even some 45 years. But on average, it's going to be more up in the 90 to 100, maybe 120 year when you look at all the different growing types across the forest.
So when you're certifying it for those products, that's going to be part of the certification is being able to sustain a growth. So our partnership with the federal government then probably is going to be pretty important.
Yes, through the chair, Senator. You want to, when you're calculating an allowable annual cut, you're going to take all those differences into account so that you can predict what an even flow might look like off the forest based on growth. And so you're always trying to capture the growth of whatever ground you're managing, ideally every year. And that would give you a nice even flow of material out of the forest. You also have to mix up stands that are further away versus stands that are close in, so you're not offering all your really expensive stuff 1 year and all your cheap stuff another year because it's close to the port. So you got to do a mix of those things to keep the costs in line. It's basically called regulating a forest is the technical term that a forester would use. And some people think about that and they think, oh my gosh, is that going to be a plantation? No, it's not. It's not going to look like rows and rows of trees. Now, in some places, they do very aggressive management like that. That's not what we're talking about when we're talking about the management we'd be doing in these forests. So I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, that does. And, of course, up in our biomass, that's probably a whole different process entirely.
That's right.
But we do have some old spruce that probably comes in pretty tight, but it's probably only good for burning, I would imagine. Although white spruce probably is good for building.
It is, through the chair, Senator Kaga. That white spruce in the interior is some of the best construction lumber we have because it is relatively slow growing. So you go into one of those box stores and look at the 2x4 they're selling. Doug Fir might have 4, 5, 6 growth rings, and you go to Northland Wood in Fairbanks, and you got about 20 growth rings, beautiful wood, nice grain, tight knots. It's really nice wood to build with. That's the only thing I build with when I build something. is that white spruce.
Good advertisement. For a long time there, I think the interior was doing most of the harvesting in Alaska.
So. It was. And the interior is a bright spot. It's slowly growing. It's not on a fast track, but there's new investment always coming in. And it's because we have that stable land base and a program that people can bank on, essentially.
So the question for the interior area is we have our state forest, but we bump up against three different types of land, mostly park land and BLM land.
Mm-hmm.
So do we get to work with the Park Service much?
To answer your question, Senator, through the chair, no, the Park Service is not that's not their bailiwick. They don't cut trees. And so it hasn't been a problem for us, you know, the Park Service. We have such a large land base that's state-owned. We have done some work with BLM. They're not a big seller of timber, but they have done some sales up in interior Alaska. Currently, I don't even know if they have a forester on staff. I don't think they do. But that's the Good Neighbor Authority again. We could approach them and say, hey, I want to use my foresters to do some projects on BLM land. We still got to do NEPA, though. That's the one key piece. That's the one piece that always stays with the feds. Is a record of decision based on an environmental process, either an EA or a full-blown NEPA.
And one last fun question.
Yes, Senator Coghill.
I noticed down in the southeast we actually do sell some of that tonewood. What does it normally go for?
Through the chair, Senator, tonewood, it's a closely guarded secret. There's a lot of, as you might imagine.
What are the products then?
Well, it's beautiful stuff. I mean, several piano companies buy tone wood out of southeast Alaska, and this is real old-growth wood. So and you can't just walk up to a tree in the woods and say, that's going to be a tone wood tree. That's very, very difficult to do. So they come to the log yards where these trees are in the log yard. They can look at the butt ends. They can look at the grain and measure it. They can look at the orientation of the grain. So there's some people that really know how to size up a log for what they're interested in. And they'll pay very, very serious money for a piece of wood that meets their criteria.
It was new information to me, and it's kind of great that at least we have somebody look at us for that.
There is. There's one mill in southeast that specializes in tone wood. Small operation. They do veneers out of the spruce for string instruments, violins, guitar tops. And actually, one of the guys on our board of forestry, Mark Binsel, builds a hobby of his. and he builds his own string instruments, does really amazing work.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Well, that was really interesting, Director Meisch. I appreciate it. And Deputy Commissioner Hansen and I were talking about agriculture earlier today, and really that's what you're doing in a sense, agriculture, right?
It is a longer time horizon associated with it.
Yes.
But it's not too different. It's really trying to manage a renewable resource like that. It's a great asset that the state has, and I think we'll get a lot more out of it in the future.
Great. Well, thank you very much for being here today. So with that, that concludes our agenda. Our next meeting is Monday, May 22nd. At that time, we'll be hearing an overview from the Department of Natural Resources again on the process of filing mining claims in the state. So at this time, we'll adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4:45 p.m.